Jody Crumpy, director of the Erie City Mission Thrift Stores and Donation Center. When you shop at one of our two thrift stores or drop off items at our donation center, you are providing a meal. You are housing a man in our shelter, helping men and women overcome addiction, and giving our inner city youth an opportunity to learn. I want to thank you for making a difference. This is our city, our mission. God bless you.
All year round, Frontier Home Products and Design has what you need to make your home comfortable and beautiful. Relax on a new timber tech deck designed by Frontier's experts. A new fireplace from Frontier Home Products Fireplace Gallery adds warmth and serenity to any home. Beauty and versatility at Frontier Home Products and Design Center, 4213 Peachtree, 5th next to the Bayfront Highway.
Frontier Home Products and Design Center. Discover a new frontier.
PA contractor number PA039007.
Welcome to TalkErie.com's Joel Natale Show, Erie, Pennsylvania's daily podcast. Every day, we tackle the biggest issues that the Erie PA region faces. Stay informed and involved as we advance the narrative of Erie. Now, here's Joel Natale.
Our topic today is the Erie County Coalition, the Erie Coalition for a Trauma-Informed Community, and the upcoming Community Resilience Conference on March 1st. With me is Nicole Platts of the Achievement Center of LECOM Health. Good to see you, Nicole.
Good to see you.
And we've got Dr. Melanie Hetzel-Riggin. She is the professor of psychology at Penn State Barron. Dr. Hetzel-Riggin, good to see you, ma'am.
Thanks for letting me be here.
You got it here. All right. Trauma-informed community. Are we becoming more trauma-informed? Like, if we had to put a report card on it, I mean, are people, digging this? Are they down with it?
Yeah, that's
Nicole?
A good question. Yeah, trauma, this conversation and the buzzword trauma became a thing like about 7 years ago, mm-hmm. across the state of Pennsylvania. And Pennsylvania was under Governor Wolf, mm-hmm. was becoming a trauma-centered, a healing-centered, trauma-informed state. And so there was a lot of work and a lot of traction around trauma and some of our treatment facilities becoming more trauma-informed. But when we think about that, can we measure it? It's real hard because it's a spectrum, right? It's mm-hmm. not an end game goal. Mm-hmm. It's something that you have to continually work at and continually educate yourself on. And it's ever-changing, right? There's these unique little nuances to it. I don't know if you have anything to add.
No, it is complicated because, there's different sectors of the community and how do you become trauma-informed or resiliency building? In the mental health and social services, I think we've got some really good evidence-based work on how to do that, and we've been following through that. But there are other sectors, such as in education sectors and law enforcement, criminal justice procedures, and just in community engagement, neighborhood organizations. And I think we've made some significant progress there, but it is hard to keep a continuous metric on where we are at. But
and it'd be interesting to know, like, you know, I mean, when you talk about law enforcement, for example, mm-hmm. or substance abuse disorder, you know, trying to sort through what is a, you know, what are appropriate consequences mm-hmm. for actions, mm-hmm. you know, while being trauma informed, understanding that, yeah, what happened to you? Mm-hmm. Because, I mean, you guys, you would agree that there's no a magic wand that says, hey, you're not responsible for your actions because you've been through trauma.
Correct. And I would say that being trauma informed doesn't say we're excusing behavior, but we're addressing people's behavior in a way that understands the context in sure. which it's happening and why it has been reinforced and continuing, and trying to find ways to support the person while also providing consequences for actions. Yeah. And where is that middle ground to be right. both supportive and rehabilitative with also having making people responsible for their behaviors? Yeah.
Yeah, we bump into this a lot when we're doing trainings in the community, specifically in some educational settings or in healthcare settings. And people say to us, well, you're just letting people do whatever they want, because a lot of trauma-informed care work is about allowing the person, right, to make their own choices, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. and create these safe spaces together. So it's this collaboration. And a lot of people say, well, then you're not holding people accountable, and that's not true. You can still have accountability while being trauma-informed and trauma-sensitive.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, you know. And the more that we are aware of that, then, I mean, we're getting to better, I would think we would hope to get to better outcomes, mm-hmm. because one of the worst things that could happen is just that cycle of violence or that cycle of recidivism, you know, the revolving door in the criminal justice system or what have you. Before I jump into the conference, I want to talk about, because you both have different areas of expertise, I want to talk about like the strata of children, teens, adults, seniors, and so on, and where we're at with mental health and trauma and so on. So when we talk about our youngest children here now, a couple years after COVID-19, are we seeing kind of some green shoots regarding mental health? Or, you know, is your waiting list huge over at the Achievement Center, Nicole?
You know, this is a great question, because a lot of times people say, like, what are the impacts of that COVID-19 pandemic and all the isolation and the abrupt loss of life, right? And yeah. And as we knew it, what are the effects on that on our young children? And, you know, we're still, the numbers are still starting to come out. We're just about to start seeing some of the data around how they have been impacted. But even pre-COVID, what we noticed was that mental health numbers, 1 in 5 children were going to be diagnosed with a mental illness over there between the ages of 15 and 18. But what happened post-pandemic is what we noticed is that younger kids mm-hmm. are being diagnosed. So the statistics, the age range, and we've now started seeing younger kids who are struggling, which wow. I don't think is surprising to anybody.
No, and I think it's always a question. I always run into this question is, are we seeing an increase in mental health concerns, particularly in younger grades, or are there now the resources mm-hmm. available for us mm-hmm. to well assess
good point.
And get kids connected with services earlier, which could also be the impact of COVID. Right. You know, one of the things about during and after the pandemic is the amount of resources available for mental health and social services increased for various different reasons. So does that mean we were able to train people to identify it earlier, to help parents understand, to get services earlier? And that's a continual question we're always going to have.
Right. The one of the biggest resources is human resources. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And again, I mean, to work where you work, do you need a master's, or more than likely you do, right, to be a certified mental health counselor?
Yeah, so the behavioral health line at LECOM Health services birth through end of life in behavioral health care. And so there's just various aspects and components of services that require high school education if we're going to be looking at someone who's working directly in a home and just an additional support service to a child or to a parent, and transferring those skills all the way up through licensed clinicians and psychologists who would be giving formal diagnoses and doing evidence-based interventions and treatment models mm-hmm. In an outpatient setting. But we offer a full gamut of services from in clinic to in home, in community, and in schools.
So are you able to recruit pretty well?
That's a challenge, right? We're seeing
so that's
less.
That's what I'm after.
We're seeing less and less people interested in coming into students, young people mm-hmm. interested in coming into the field. And so we're even seeing lower enrollment. And maybe you can speak to this.
Yeah, and actually, we're finding the difference because I, being affiliated with the university, we actually are seeing more people being interested in the field. We have a master's degree in applied clinical psychology at Barron, and we're seeing an increase in okay. people interested in it. But then you get into what are the resources to support those students, sure. both in terms of their educational experiences and their on-site training experiences and internship, and those requires people who to supervise them who are licensed. So there's a bit of a systemic, and then supervision after graduation. Mm-hmm. So I think the interest is there. It's just, do we have the relationships among the different sectors to train them well and get them then placed, and then be able to pay for the cost of living, because it is also. Yeah. a concern regarding pay.
Yeah, and that's a good point, because the need is so high that oftentimes we need them to come out of school and hit the ground running, but there's so much training that needs to happen, yeah. right? And really, in order to really set them up for success, mm-hmm. because the challenges are that they're up against with the children and the family that they're going to work with are pretty, they're pretty mm-hmm. significant.
Well, that's pretty hopeful, though, mm-hmm. that we're seeing that mm-hmm. that you're having some interest, because mm-hmm. Let's just face it, all of humanity is struggling mm-hmm. right now mm-hmm. in recruiting mm-hmm. compared to young people that want to go into STEM fields and, you know, get that engineering degree and you know, mm-hmm. rock and roll, right? So you got that. You got that that bigger thing. You're seeing that in like in the teaching field, mm-hmm. very difficult to recruit, mm-hmm. right? So that's a good thing that, you know, people are willing to be specialists. Mm-hmm. Now, maybe we need a few generalists mm-hmm. that say, hey, I want to do personal care, or mm-hmm. I want to do home health care, or I want to do teaching, mm-hmm. or I want to become a nurse, you know, and that seems to be the rub right now.
Yeah. I would say also, you know, I think we're having a decent time recruiting people to the field. Part of it is retaining them in the field, which is also going back to the trauma-informed care model, not just for the people that we serve as mental health professionals, but also the mental health professionals and organizations in which we work too, is making sure the organizations, educational institutions are trauma-informed in their policies and procedures so that you don't see burnout and you see that in education and in mental yeah. health, and making sure that is supporting the providers as
like,
well.
Like, I'd be interested in knowing what a best practice would be to convince that, because we hear this is the story that we're hearing now, right? Is okay, they just killed themselves to get their education degree. They pass their praxis. Mm-hmm. They're in the field. They get through a year. They get through another year. And they are toast. Mm-hmm. And like, what is the best practice for an administrator, a building principal or something, to use trauma-informed care to build some more resiliency into that mm-hmm. into that teacher? What would you say?
I'm a big advocate of continual supervision. That's not just about the supervision of you know, the practitioners and their work with the clients, but also on their own professional development and how can they get connected with resources they might need to, you know, even if it's things like financial assistance once you start to have to repay your loans or supporting themselves when they have a really tough case that maybe it's hard for them to really process, is making sure that like multi-tiered supervision is really important. That's one thing I've found to be really useful.
Yeah. And we don't ever do a trauma training or talk about, you know, any of this without circling back to self-care. Mm-hmm. Right. Because it really, you can't pour from an empty cup. And right. so a lot of times in this profession, we care so much. We're so compassionate that we're give. And we often forget to give to ourselves first. So we always partner mm-hmm. Any of our trainings and our outreach efforts around self-care. And what are you doing to prevent, to promote wellness and prevent burnout?
Mm-hmm. Just punch me back. But is there something about this generation of 25-year-olds, though, that, and this is the narrative from the 65-year-olds, is saying that these 25-year-olds just don't have any grit or tenacity. So they can't handle the stress box in that grade school or high school.
I don't think that's the case. I think they're less willing to put their head down and keep going to the grindstone. I think they're more willing to advocate for themselves, which leads to different challenges when we're looking at supporting employees, because they are going to be willing to say, I'm here's a boundary and I'm not going to move through it. So how do we change our systems to address the fact that if you give these young people, here's your role, they'll do it, but on their own terms. And that's a shift in how we manage people.
And it's different. I mean, it's different than the 45-year-old teacher.
Oh, yeah. At least in my experience, yeah. there's various differences in how people are employees between the generations, truthfully, in my experience.
Again, these are broad strokes. I get it. Right. But what we're calling on is the grownups, the administrators, mm-hmm. to say, hey, look, man, mm-hmm. you've got to change your tactics mm-hmm. because these millennials or these Zers are not like mm-hmm. your Xer mm-hmm. Compadres, you know. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. I agree with what you said. You know, it's kind of like the older generation, put your head down, get through it kind of thing. The expression
that's
often
what my dad told me to do.
You know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps kind of thing and get on with it, right? Yeah. But that's just not how it is anymore. I mean, mm-hmm. we have access to different things. We know things differently with mm-hmm. social media. So they have a larger platform to have a louder voice in getting what they want or how mm-hmm. they want it. And a lot of our systems were built a while ago and could use some, you know, revamping.
But it's interesting because I've been teaching for over 20 years, and I I've been doing trauma-informed teaching practices for a while. I like to say I was interested in trauma before it became cool.
Sure.
And I was teaching 20 years ago students, you know, okay, you know, we have this idea of you need to pull yourself up by your bootstraps, but what happens to those people who don't have boots? And now those people are saying, well, we don't have boots, so we need to do it a different way. And you're right. Like, okay, well, you listen. But now we, as people who've been in this field for a while, have to be like, okay, so now we have to change the systems and how we do things, which is then a challenge for those of us. And how do we,
well, and,
how do we
and think about managing again, differently? Think about the ecosystem that you're in. Mm-hmm. Most of these organizations are funded through government programs. Mm-hmm. So you have legislators and you have executive branches that are, that, you know, haven't looked at this stuff ever. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, the trauma-informed deal starts at the very top, and you're trying to move, you know, ancient bureaucracies to be more enlightened, I guess.
True. But I would say I echo Nicole's point that Pennsylvania has been working a bit to really do things at the state level.
Yeah.
In terms of looking at legislation, particularly about training, for example, pre-service teachers in trauma-informed policies. There's initiatives to try to make sure upcoming people in the social services and mental health practice have understanding of the impact of trauma. So I think there has been movement, but, you know, it takes a while for it to really disseminate down to everyday on the boots on the ground people.
You're at your third year now. Mm-hmm. How's it gone so far, and what are your hopes for this year's?
Yes, so this used to be a collaboration that we held with Crawford County Human Services. And so we had 7 years with them and running. It used to be known as the Edinburgh University Conference. So lots of folks would want to participate. We would often sell out seats in a matter of minutes after launching registration. We maxed out because of capacity issues simply at the location we were having it at. And so we took a hard look at the needs in Erie County and said, we can do this on our own. And we need to, because we have a lot of folks who are interested in this and who need this kind of training. And so we took it on as ECTIC, and we had our first one 3 years ago, like you said, and it was virtual. And we had over 1,600 people register
for
that conference. And we ended up with only 890, I think, attended, but that was a great reach. We reached 16 different states. and we had a great keynote speaker that year. And so we were really energized around this. And we were like, yes, we told you we need this here in Erie. And people are interested and eager to learn more. Our second conference, we said, let's come back. We were longing for connection. And so much of what we do in the trauma work is about connecting, right? We heal in relationships, and we really want to foster those throughout the county. And so we held it down at the Bayfront Convention Center last year in February. We wished for a better turnout, but I think that people got really used to virtual and just kind of clicking in and out of meetings without the transportation time. And so this year we went back, we took some feedback from the group, and we went back to 100% virtual conference, allowing people, even if they can't attend the full day, to be able to jump in and out to a session that might be applicable to them. So really trying to meet the needs and meet people where they're at so they can participate this year.
So you have a keynote speaker here, Allison Massari. Will she just stay where she's put?
She is.
Okay, that makes it easy.
She's located in, I think, San Diego is where she's home-based. And so that's why you're going to see a little bit different structure in this year's conference agenda, with our keynote is going to take us home at the end of the day.
Okay.
She's going to go on at 3 p.m. Eastern Standard Time via Zoom. You have to be registered to get that link. But if you don't know about her, I've had the pleasure of connecting with her a few times. She's one of those people who just brings so much light and hope and energy into the space. You kind of want to bottle her up and, like, share her with everybody because she's that wonderful. She's a trauma survivor, and I think a lot of times in the work that we're doing, we hear from people in roles of education or in the, you know, experts in the field, and we don't often hear the other side of things. What was it like for you, you know, to heal, and what helped you, what worked, what didn't work? And so, yeah, she shares her story of being a trauma survivor. She was actually in a horrific car accident that she was almost burned alive, saved her life within a matter of seconds, and she's an artist.
Okay.
And so the way she tells her story is just really beautiful. And for visual people, it just kind of brings it all together. But I don't know if you want to say anything about trauma survivors, the impact.
No, I think it's really, I'm really glad we're having her sort of cap off the conference, because, you know, we can talk to the day is long about what does the evidence say and what are best practices and how do we integrate this. But really, the people who we need to hear back the most from are the people who are surviving and yeah. what their experiences was, because they're the ones who are going to be the most impacted by what we do. So I'm really glad that we're able to get her to speak at our conference.
I've got a minute before the bottom of the hour. Who is this conference for? Like, you know, if I'm sitting here listening to this, how would it make a difference for me? You know, who's it for?
I think anybody who wants to be involved in trying to make Erie a more trauma-informed and resiliency-growing place. And that can be just regular citizens or anybody in professions where that feels like a need that they want to engage in.
But like teachers, obviously social workers. Yep.
We say everybody. Everybody yeah. has a role to play in this. Mm-hmm. Everyone's okay. a member of the community. Everybody needs to know about this. The traditional audience we get are teachers, social workers, people in the helping profession, mm-hmm. anybody who volunteers, mm-hmm. Faith-based members, that sort of thing.
Right.
But it really is for anybody. If you're a trauma survivor, we encourage you to come, mm-hmm. you know, have maybe like a support plan in place in case you're triggered by something that you hear. But it really is for anybody.
The theme mentioned building domains of resilience. What's a domain?
I guess it's the way we are defining it is the broader strokes of what are the ways people can become more trauma-informed and engage in resiliency building activities. And so the four that we identify with for this conference, but also have been demonstrated to be really effective yeah. in helping people grow in their resiliency skills are our purpose, perspective, developing relationships, and wellness. And so those are the four areas that we're really focusing our talks and our content on for the conference to be consistent with those themes.
So do you anticipate kind of a broad spectrum of kind of theory and then practicality? How do you usually approach these sessions?
Anyone who wants to present at the conference, we obviously say we want some of the content and the why behind why you're doing it, but then the practical applicability. We want someone to walk away with another tool in their toolbox that they can immediately implement and make Erie region a better place for everybody.
Wow. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. And I mean, that's a pretty big goal, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, mm-hmm. Because what you're hoping is that at different strata for different cohorts, different groups, the trauma-informed practitioner, for lack of a better word, or the influencer, I should mm-hmm. say, or leader, just is better at their game, better at their relationship, better at their communication.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. I think the tricky part about trauma is we often aren't preventative enough about it, right? And so then we're stuck with the, like, what's happened to you part, which is really complex and challenging. It takes a lot of time and true trained professionals to help someone heal and kind of go through that journey with them. But the prevention side of it is just becoming a better human, right? Mm-hmm. And we can all do that. We can do that as the checkout clerk. We can do that as, you know, the pastor at a church. We can do that in any role, sister, brother, whatever parent. Yeah. You can do that when you're shifting your perspective, when you're learning how to interact with people differently, when you understand the importance of relationships and how to connect with people and how meaningful that is and how powerful it can be when you're connected to your community, then you're not doing more harm. Mm-hmm. Right? You're not part of the problem. You're part of the long-term solution.
Mm-hmm. We talk, at least I talk a lot about my frustration with emotional maturity. Mm. So, you know, I'm frustrated that I encounter 60-year-olds that act like they're 14. And that's just, you know, me being a jerk. But I mean, what you're asking people to do is advanced maturity. It's advanced emotional maturity, right? Mm-hmm. And that takes some chutzpah. It takes some, you know, will.
Yeah, it does. But it also helps the person themselves, right?
Sure.
It's a win for everybody. I think sometimes we get stuck in how we have always done things or how our family has always done things, or things are different, or, you know, the kids these days, as we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
So giving people tools to be able to enter those situations where you know, maybe there's a tendency towards frustration or irritability, but giving them the tools to, you know, think about things like, can I just take a second, look back, look at it from a broader perspective, and what's the best outcome I want here, mm-hmm. and how do I go about doing that so that I feel better about the situation, as does the people I'm interacting with. So those little tiny tools versus broad strokes of
change.
But
it takes some emotional intelligence, doesn't it?
It takes some, but I think the perspective piece that we're trying to get folks understand here is that the perspective needs to be, not everyone would have been taught that. Not everyone has been exposed to that. Not everyone could cultivate that or had it nurtured in them when they were growing up or role modeled for them. And so when you're talking about, you know, an older generation, right, we have to ask ourselves, what's our perspective on this situation? Mm. And did we ask ourselves, did they ever learn this?
Sure, sure. Let's talk about some of the topics, the big morning keynote, building blocks of resilience, looking at evidence-based trauma-informed practices implemented within the K-12 educational setting. So right off the bat, you're really focusing in on the K-12 teacher and the folks that are in the building, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we're going to start the morning off with educators, I'm sorry, from Mill Creek School District. We got Dr. Joseph Jablinski and Mary are presenting that one. We're really hoping that that helps educators just get a little bit of little nugget of information on how they can structure their classrooms, how they can interact with children to build their own resilience. Mm-hmm. I know a lot of our schools are focused on social emotional learning curriculums, right. And we're starting at earlier ages to kind of get that, like you said, that EQ, that emotional intelligence type stuff built into the daily routine, and so that's really helpful. But we're starting the morning off with something directly related to those who are in the school districts or educators themselves, and we're really excited that today our friends over at the Intermediate Unit 5 out in Edinburgh are sponsoring our Act 48 credits, so okay. Any educators who need continuing mm-hmm. education credits can get those by their attendance.
That sounds like a great thing for them. The second session is the second time slot has two sessions. One is supporting Black and Brown professionals in the world of DEI, and the second is the power perspective as a building block of resilience. In this field, how are we doing with recruitment and of people of color? Are more and more folks of color coming into these humanities and social sciences like this?
We're starting to see that. I think we are. I've noticed that the diversity in our students in the helping professions is starting to become more diverse, and we're making intentional reaches into previously less populated groups of people. Again, it's a struggle because they're coming with different perspectives that even our educational, the way we teach has had to change. Okay. You know, I think about we teach, you know, courses in cultural competency, mm-hmm. and it's very different when you're a white person, as I am, talking to other white people about what does that mean versus I'm a white person talking to a diverse group of students. Yeah. Who have lived experiences there, and so even how we teach and think about things is changing. But I do think we're making some strides. I think the hardest struggle is we don't have educators necessarily of color who can right. then make those professional supervisory and mentorship relationships. But I think we're slowly getting there. Retaining them in the community is also a bit of a challenge in the mm-hmm. region.
Well, yeah, I mean, again, just like any young mm-hmm. person. If they get a boatload of skills, mm-hmm. if there's mm-hmm. know, the South mm-hmm. is calling their name, you know, and they can plant in Charlotte or Nashville, mm-hmm. That's kind of that brain drain that we've been suffering mm-hmm. all across the spectrum, isn't it? Mm-hmm. The power perspective is a building block of resilience. That's kind of what we've been talking about all this whole conversation is, you know, put yourself, have a little empathy, get some perspective. And you can build some resilience. The next time slot here is becoming well-rooted, techniques to strengthen your resilience. And the second one is understanding sexual violence, risk factors, and treatment. All right, I'd love to learn how to be well-rooted here. So you have any previews?
The well-rooted one is going to be done by Dr. Megan Kinter. And
oh, I know Megan.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, she's going to talk about that kind of that work-life rhythm. That,
okay.
Right. A lot of people say it's a balance, but it's really this rhythm and mm-hmm. some cadence that you have to find when there's various things that are dominating in your personal life. You know, you might have to spend more time there and then versus, you know, your work life. So there's never this idea of balance. So shifting your perspective on that and finding a way to kind of like ground yourself, understand your purpose, do things knowing your why, right? Mm. And how does that kind of give you a better sense of self and awareness and life and joy?
I find, again, pushback, but I find that people don't understand their strengths very well. I run into full-grown adults that have no clue of their why, of why they're on, you know, what their God-given talents are. You know, I'm a huge advocate for the Strength Finders book, mm-hmm. you know, the Gallup tool. It's just like, it just opens things up for you. And I don't know how you could skate through school without knowing this, but I keep encountering people that don't. Mm-hmm. Or they go into a field in college because their parents want them to. Meanwhile, they I'm frustrated and I don't know mm-hmm. what I'm here for. I mean, that's tough. And so you don't become very resilient, do you?
Right. And I think it's easier to move towards burnout if you don't, you know, play into careers that and in jobs that focus on your strengths. 100% agree. But again, that goes to who are the people in their lives that maybe didn't have that knowledge mm-hmm. themselves, mm-hmm. parents, family members, educators.
I think a lot of times when we're thinking about work, we're thinking about making money, right? And so we go to the places that might give us the lifestyle we want, make the money that we want to spend, right? So we don't always think about, like, I'm going to do this job for essentially the bulk of my lifetime, right? Mm-hmm. And so I should do something that is fun, it isn't considered hard work and stressful and gonna, you know, you're gonna have those periods of time in any position, any job, no however, but like if you can be mm-hmm. fulfilled and think you're doing a good job, then you're less likely to feel burnout.
Mm-hmm. I want you to comment about this session about understanding sexual violence and, mm-hmm. and then later on you're talking about an epidemic in our rights, military sexual trauma. Are we more aware of sexual violence that is happening to people now than ever before? I mean, it's not being under the rug like it used to be.
I think we do have a better knowledge base about sort of the experiences of various people and their experiences of sexual violence, as well as where to get help. But it's still a challenge in certain sectors, even defining what sexual violence is and what's acceptable behaviors within relationships. And so I think we tend to have this, we still do, this sort of idea that sexual violence occurs with a stranger jumping out of a bush. And that's actually not the most common. No. It's actually, that's the least frequent. Mm-hmm. And so when people have that experience, it's very easy to be able to seek, you know, services from advocates or from the criminal justice system. Whereas if sexual violence is happening within acquaintance relationships or romantic relationships, which is the most common, it's harder to, first of all, acknowledge that this person who you care about hurt you. But then also, how do you go about and get you know, you press charges or you get services or things. So I think I'm glad we're including this in our conference to continue to spread the word about, like, what does sexual violence look like for across different contexts? And then particularly within the military, because there's been a lot of work, particularly over the last 10 years, about the epidemic of military sexual trauma and how much it hurts soldiers and the people within the military system. So
that's a good point that oftentimes, depending on how it happens or how you're victimized, you don't reach out, and then you just carry this shame and this guilt with you, and that leads to more mental health issues, right? No one's going to feel good about themselves after something like that's happened to them. And so talking about it and not normalizing that's not the right word, but like normalizing help-seeking behaviors is really important,
and particularly helping bystanders understand that if someone, you know, reaches out to you and say that they were victimized, to believe them. It seems like a very simple thing, but it is one of the hardest things to do, particularly if that bystander happens to know both parties. That gets really tricky sometimes in like friend groups and family groups.
Amazing. Also, after lunch is the We Are Human, Not Broken Tell me about that.
Kevin Verselli does that one, and he's pretty much a staple at all of our conferences. Mm-hmm. He's been doing this for a really long time. He does the tension release exercises. And so oftentimes when folks are victims of trauma or just adversity or chronic stress and pain, they hold it all in their body, right? I don't know if anybody's heard, like, the body keeps the score, but oftentimes, like, people can't accurately remember the traumatic events that have happened to them. They can't recall them as they occurred. But what happens is your body holds onto it. Mm-hmm. And so doing these tensing and relaxation exercises makes you become more aware of where you're holding the stress and the tension in your body in order to call it out and release it. And so it's really effective. It's effective just like any other thing that mm-hmm. we would use. You know, a lot of people talk about the polyvagal theory, but then there's eye movement desensitization. So, like, when you're moving your body and you're pairing it with memory recall and, you know, a supportive environment and person to, like, help you heal, it's more effective than just traditional talk therapy.
I've never heard this before.
Mm-hmm.
That's really remarkable.
Yeah.
So body movement and exercises. Mm-hmm. Particularly mm-hmm. about processing memories.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, trauma affects all parts of your body, your cognition, your thoughts, your emotions, your behaviors, but also your physiological state.
Yeah.
And so by sort of retraining your body on how to release that tension and purposely and intentionally doing it, it can lead to various types of healing.
Wow. Because,
mm-hmm.
yeah, I mean, I totally can get the blow against you, but... Mm-hmm. Being able to reverse that back out.
Mm-hmm.
That's pretty remarkable stuff. Mm-hmm. Wow. Mm-hmm. To finish the day is the Connecting with Youth, Resiliency in Relationship Building. And we talked a bit about this, but that generational gap, unfortunately, that's out there. But it feels like to me that... again, having the adults kind of be reminded or relearn mm-hmm. communication skills with youth would be helpful.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. The youth are our future, right?
And
so we have to start transferring skills to them, educating them, teaching them how to, we call it be gritty almost, like, right? How do you get resilient? How do you have a little bit of grit to you? How do you overcome adversity? How do you communicate about your needs? How do you seek help when you need it? And so it's really important that we're talking about the youth and we're incorporating the people that support and service them and educating mm-hmm. them as well.
And it's really what research has shown time and time and again is that one trusted adult can make or break the focus of where a youth goes. If you can have if youth who have one trusted adult person in their educational church space, wherever, who they rely on, who can help them through difficult times, that is such a huge supportive piece. And so, you know, this particular presentation really talks about how do you develop that with youth mm-hmm. to really help them grow into their resiliency.
Wow. And then finally at 3:00, the keynote address, as we mentioned earlier, Allison Massari from San Diego. Again, she's experienced trauma. What do you think she's going to want to leave people with?
I think she's going to have a really compelling story of hope, right? And how to not give up. But she's also going to do it through a lens of, I've been there. I've been through the darkest, deepest hole in my life, and I came out on the other side, but I couldn't have done it alone.
Yeah.
And I think she's really going to speak to how it takes a village to really help people after something terrible mm-hmm. has happened.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I don't always get, you know, experts with lots of letters after their names sitting at these microphones. So I think about the moms, dads, grandparents that might be listening.
Mm-hmm.
And talk about communication and a helpful approach to mm-hmm. To a child, to a youth, to maybe a coworker,
mm-hmm.
to maybe, you know, maybe a peer where you're really having a struggle. What would be a pro tip, maybe just on either a relational or communications mm-hmm. basis? What would you share?
You know, the first thing is just to listen, even if you disagree, even if there's going to be consequences, even if there's a problem, it's just to truly listen to what the other person is saying, whether that's a youth, whether that's a coworker, whether that's your partner, and really try to see where they're coming from. And then even just some basic stuff of trying to, you know, rephrase what they're saying to make sure you understand. Because I think sometimes a lot of conflict and a lot of challenges, whether that's in parenting or coworker stress or whatever, happens because we really don't understand what the other person is experiencing. And just some really basic active listening skills to truly understand what
the
other person is.
You got to put the phone away.
Put a phone away.
And turn the radio off or whatever.
And just really truly listening to the people that you're talking with and that you care about. And then trying to invite them to listen to your experience. That is a first step, can be so changing. Because once you understand, even if you disagree, even if there's going to be consequences to unhealthy behavior, you at least know where they're coming from and can talk from a place of understanding versus defensiveness. So it's a real simple thing that's not so simple to do, but it is, I think, a huge first step that if we can just listen to each other.
And that really is kind of, I mean, when you're trying to be trauma informed, and you've taught me, Nicole, that trauma is basically, you know, when you encounter something that is you lack coping skills to deal with it, right? I mean, a lot of us are able to cope with you know, being bullied when I was in grade school or whatever, you know, but you know, we're functioning adults, but it does inform, you know, our skittishness even well into our 60s. You know what I mean? So being able to say, hey, look, I don't want to repeat that bad behavior by, and using these listening skills, I think that's super important. I appreciate it. Thank you so much. We are excited for you on March 1st. The Erie County Community Resilience Conference. Nicole Platts from Achievement Center of LECOM Health. Dr. Melanie Hetzel-Riggin from Penn State Barron. Go Humanities!
Thank you, I agree.
We need a push.
You've been listening to The Joel Natale Show, Erie, Pennsylvania's daily podcast from TalkErie.com. Subscribe to our show on your favorite podcatcher and get involved by emailing joel@TalkErie.com.